Chapter 20. Father of the Bride. Peter hadn't written anything down yet for his speech, but he had allowed a healthy collection of ideas to build up over the preceding weeks. He had asked Grace to meet him for a walk, just to run through a few things, but also to check in with her in case she was having a meltdown from the pre-wedding stress, which was certainly Helen's view of the whole situation. Peter had spent his career as a peripatetic economist, starting out as a researcher, then lecturer, before trying a disastrous turn as the in-house economist for a bank, and then finally, on the off-ramp of his career, returning to an academic backwater, doing what he had liked doing most all along, teaching economics to interested young people. He had seen the economics profession change over the years. When he started, they were all idealists who believed that they held the missing piece of the puzzle in solving societal problems. Over time, the job seemed to change from one of understanding and decoding the market to advocating for it. It had become a job devoid of ideological diversity and ambivalent in its methods, disdaining the soft-centred humanity of the social sciences, but not quite committing to the disciplined empiricism of the physical sciences. Instead, it ended up as an add-on to arts and business courses, or else dominated by maths graduates who found it easier than real maths. Throughout that time, Peter had always been good at presentations and lectures. He knew how to build a narrative and drop in what seemed like effortless pieces of prepared spontaneity. Over a long career, he had amassed a tidy repertoire of humorous anecdotes and self-deprecating digressions, sometimes featuring Helen or his children, though not by name, which meant that he was able to keep his presentations fresh enough to entertain those of his colleagues who had heard him speak regularly. It always made him marvel that introverts made the best speakers, perhaps taking themselves less seriously than the showboating businessmen who usually took the appearance fee slots at conferences. Peter's trick was simple. He never made it about himself. He never put his fragile ego or reputation at stake, instead letting the subject be the star. For all his easygoing delivery, he prepared meticulously and placed great emphasis on maintaining what he called a boxer's mind. Relaxed enough to deliver what he needed, but alert enough not to get punched in the face. As good as he was, it took a lot out of him. He recalled a conference some years ago, previously, where he had given a lengthy talk to a ballroom full of international climate economists, after which, feeling exhausted, he had shut himself inside his hotel room for the rest of the evening and demolished two large chocolate Santas. His Father of the Bride speech would be a little different. Peter knew that he needed to go beyond a performance and finishing with an aw. He wanted to dig inside himself, to find the most sincere thing he could say. Though it wouldn't be easy, he had to mine past his obvious love and affection for Grace into the molten core of their relationship, where deep connections had been forged between them. Most of all, he wanted her to embark on her new life with his full blessing, to know that her marriage was not a case of moving on or letting go, but manifest proof of her mastery of her own life. The very fact that she had, by her instincts and judgment, uncovered the path to happiness was the culmination of her own self-taught apprenticeship. Peter had seen many Father of the Bride speeches given over the years, including by his friends and colleagues, and they were the one aspect of the big day that never went wrong. At worst, the speeches could be a little unoriginal or could end up as a two-person tango between the father and his daughter, but there was never anything inappropriate or off-colour in them. Men of his generation were generally good judges of tone on these occasions, recognising that the bride and groom were entitled to a little dignity on their special day. He liked Andrew a lot. When he and Helen first met him, they wondered whether Grace had gone for a trophy boyfriend. Good-looking, seemed to have a few bob, plight to the parents, but without the creativity or edge they had always assumed was part of Grace's taste in men. Her job surprised them similarly. They had always thought she would end up working in a creative field, though at the practical end, as a gallery curator or literary editor. Instead, she had become successful at what Helen called a big job with a US multinational. Incrementally, her job had grown into a career that took over her time like Ivy, even though she had not yet given up on restoring some sort of balance to her busy and serious life. Over time, they saw Andrew's deeper side, the sincerity of his feeling, and above all, his devotion to Grace. Grace spent so much of her life being together that she needed someone she could trust, around whom she could regress a little bit and be a flake. Andrew seemed to understand her better on that level, that aloof side to her personality that was still something of a mystery to her parents, in particular Helen. Peter always remembered the cheerful loyalty that Andrew showed in the early days when Grace was sick with glandular fever. It was probably hard for Grace to allow herself to be looked after by a new boyfriend before she had had a proper opportunity to set out her own terms for the relationship. But when you see a young man, too young to know how young he is, taking care of your daughter and doing it well, and most amazing of all, her letting him do it, a father realizes that nature is taking its course. Peter had arranged to meet Grace at the magazine section of the newsagent in the village, so that whoever arrived first could wait in the warm and dry and busy themselves with some aimless browsing. Peter got there early and opened The Economist, which he noticed was still recommending Economics 101 for every crisis the world over. Grace arrived a few minutes later and kissed him on the cheek before saying hello. "Oh, your cheeks are cold. How are things?" he asked.
"Good, good. Sorry I'm a bit late. Couldn't get parking. Where do you want to walk? Stay local or head off somewhere?"
"Well, if you have parking, let's stay local. Up around the back of the golf course, maybe?"
"Okay, we can sell any golf balls we find to help pay for the wedding."
They walked along with Grace linking her dad's elbow. A chilly April breeze had taken up, and there was a little bite in the air now that the sun was sinking. Grace put her woolly scarf over her head, and Peter took out his Thinsulate hat, neither of them taking any chances with a head cold so close to the wedding.
"So, how are all the arrangements going?"
he asked.
"Oh, fine, fine. Usual schmoozle."
"I hope you're getting to enjoy the build-up and that it's not getting on top of you. You always push yourself too hard."
"Thanks, ma'am.
You can tell her that I'm fine and that I'm even starting to relax a tiny bit. Andrew and I met for lunch today and we didn't even discuss the wedding arrangements. He just sat there and stared at me lovingly while I ate his pizza."
"I'm no doctor, but I think if you eat someone else's pizza, it still counts towards your cholesterol. Seriously, though, is there anything bugging you that I could help with?"
"I have to confess that I am looking forward to a time, hopefully not too far away, when people are no longer asking how I am, how things are going, and whether I'm all excited. I don't mean to sound ungrateful, and people are just being kind, but it will be nice to retreat back to being an ordinary participant in the conversation. You know me, I don't like a fuss, and I am doing my best to play up to the occasion, but it's getting a bit tiring. My battery is starting to bleep a bit."
"I know what you mean. That sort of thing puts some people off weddings altogether. When the day comes, you'll just get a burst of positivity. I wasn't keen on fuss when your mother and I got married, but I remember looking out at the church and realizing that I'd never been to a wedding before where I had personal one-to-one moments with everyone in the room. I actually got quite emotional. I hope you feel something similar. At least you have a lovely holiday to look forward to afterwards."
"I can't wait for that. I hope I can rest on the flight and that I don't get flattened by jet lag on top of the wedding tiredness. How about you and ma'am? Have you given any more thought to going on a trip yourselves?"
"Oh, we talked about it a bit. She seems to be a little keener than she was, but not quite ready to make a decision for definite. She's ruled out Asia because you'll be there."
"Oh my God, what an excuse," scoffed Grace.
"She's not daft. She knows you won't bump into each other. She just doesn't want you to think she's tracking you everywhere."
"So what's holding her back? She doesn't have to do a long flight if she doesn't want to. You could go to some European capital or something."
"I think she's still unsure about your brother. He's making a real effort with things, what with the hospital volunteering and the competition and everything, but he still has his moments."
"But Dad, he's a grown man. He needs to stand up for himself. Yes, I know he has struggles, but now is the time to get him going under his own steam. In fact, it would have been great to have done it 10 years ago. Now he's got used to bumming about and relying on the two of you. You've done everything for him. You need to start pushing him a little bit.
I know, I know. We just want to be careful, that's all. And your mother just wants to be sure. I suppose you'll be away, and then you have your own life to lead, so we're just not sure what happens if something goes awry. I think your mother would feel better if there was a plan B, you know, just in case of emergencies.
If that's directed at me, I'm afraid I'm going to have to disappoint you. I can't spend my whole life as his babysitter. I need to move on, Dad. So do you and Mam. We need to take off the stabilizers, for his sake as much as our own. Did you say anything about the competition money? You know he tried to offer it to me for the wedding. I said, no, of course, we're over budget, but only because we're spoiling ourselves. I told him that he should think about doing something for you two. Has he said anything more about it?
Not as far as I know. But we don't need the money. Why complicate things? We just want to see him set up, and we need to get ready to make that leap ourselves. I think I'm ready, but you know how your mam is. She'll try and support him, but she wouldn't relax if she didn't think it was all figured out.
But you and Mam really need a break. Don't become one of those couples who leave it too late to travel and do all the things you've earned for yourselves.
We're not finished yet, chicken, but I know what you're saying. Just be patient, okay? Especially with your mam. I think the wedding has kept her mind off the future, but she'll start to wonder about all that once you've tied the knot good and tight.
They stopped at the end of the loop and began the walk back, the turnaround resetting the conversation topic.
"So, tell me about your speech?"
asked Grace, hugging into Peter a bit now that they were facing back into the wind on the return leg.
"I haven't written anything down yet, but I think I'm in the zone, so I need to start deciding on what I'm doing. Are you going to say a few words?"
"I'll see on the day. Not a speech, maybe just a few thank yous."
"Word of advice. You can improvise a speech, but you shouldn't improvise thank yous. You're bound to forget someone, and you won't get a second chance, so write them down. I made that mistake at my own wedding and forgot to thank your Aunt Sarah, who had made the cake. She was so nice about it, but I knew that I'd hurt her feelings."
"If I can make one request for your own speech, keep it classy. No digging up embarrassing stories or poking fun at Andrew."
"Good Lord, of course not. I may be an idiot, but I'm not that type of idiot. You know that I think the world of you, and that I love you, and that I'm so proud of you. This could be the only chance I get to say all those things in front of people. I need to find the right word so I don't choke up. I can see my throat getting lumpy if I go too deep."
"Lumpy is fine. Lumpy but classy is what we're aiming for. Why get so upset? I moved out yonks ago, and I've been with Andrew for a few years, even living together. Nothing changes, you know. It's just a ritual."
"I know you say that, but it does matter. Wait and see. Once Andrew is your husband, things will seem subtly changed. There's a new type of closeness you feel, even if there's no logical reason to feel different. Part of me looks at you and realizes that our family is changing. It's all good and natural, and I'm not getting soppy about it, but it seems like the end of a long first chapter. Your favorite brother, who you say is so hopeless, actually put me straight about the whole thing. He's very wise in his own way. I was talking to your mother about how we were losing you and all that sort of stuff, and he just pipes up, 'Everything you're talking about is already past.' He just drops that on us while looking in the fridge for something. And I suppose he's right. Everything I'm holding on to is already gone. Memories feel real, but they're not. Your brother just snapped me out of it. He never seems caught in the past. You never hear him talking about it. He never seems to look back, or at least he never seems stuck in something that has happened. Watch him the next time you spill something. His whole attitude is that it has already happened, and he just moves on to cleaning it up. He's all about what's going on now. I'm not sure if that's the cause or effect of the way he is, but he can be great for bringing a little bit of clarity to things. One time I was going on about work and how I was overlooked for promotion and how ageist it all was, and he just cuts me off and says, 'That's just a story. Nothing more, just like that. That's just a story.' And the thing is, he was right. It was just a story I was telling myself. When I stopped telling it, it went away."
"I'm sure it's nice to have a live-in sage," replied Grace, But even sages need to fend for themselves in the end. They arrived back at the car, their chins frozen, but glad to have squeezed each other in.
Do you want to come back to the house? Your mother would be delighted to see you.
Sorry. Send her my love. I promised I'd crank up the old laptop at home with Andrew and start booking tours and stuff for the honeymoon. Thanks for the meeting, Dad. It's not all in the past, by the way. Tell our little guru that I'm not finished with you all just yet. Grace got on her tiptoes and gave him a kiss on the chin, kidding around. She climbed into her car and pulled away with a little beep-beep of farewell, leaving Peter to nip back into the newsagent to buy the copy of The Economist he had been browsing earlier, just for something to read while he thought about his speech.